The next case set for argument, appeal number 30365, State of South Dakota versus Stephen Tope. Mark Cady is present, will be arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Tope. Tracy Miller is also present. And then we have Jacob Dempsey, Assistant Attorney General, who will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your argument, and then Mr. Cady, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed.
May it please the court and counsel. The appellant thanks this court for allowing him to have some additional pages in his brief to ask for relief. There were a number of complicated issues here from what ironically turned out to be a fairly brief trial. And I want to call attention to one part of the record that illustrates a foundation for the appellant's case. I'd ask you to please consider the trial court's finding about evidence in the record that justified providing a lesser included instruction for simple assault. The trial court found, quote, "There is a big enough range of how the jury could view what it saw in the video in terms of where or how Tupa struck Mousseau." That's from Trial Transcript Volume 3 at page 21. So such evidence existed. It was there. Some evidence actually found should defeat any suggestion that overwhelming evidence is present here, and therefore that no prejudice is shown. I refer you to State versus Huber at 2010, South Dakota 63, at paragraphs 36.
Yeah, but is that right? Isn't, how could a court, if there's some evidence of it, how could a court say, yeah, I'm not going to give the LIO because there's overwhelming evidence, as I weigh the evidence, that discounts the LIO? The court's standard for giving a lesser included instruction isn't whether there's overwhelming evidence or not. It's not to weigh the evidence. It's just to give it if there's enough evidence to submit it. So isn't that apples and oranges?
No. I think if you look at the Lando case from a few years back and Huber, you need to have some evidence. Is there something in the record that would have a sufficient foundation, however tenuous, to match the defense's case?
And how does that, how would that then, I understand your argument there, but I understood you say if the court made that determination, gave the LIO, there can never be a claim that there was overwhelming evidence for the greater offense. Did I hear it right?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because of the number of offenses that are in play. It goes from the top of the list, a Class B felony, murder two, all the way down to simple assault. And it brings with it so many issues with it. Deadly force versus just regular force being used. There's so many things that go along with it. And
counsel, can I ask you, in your alternative counts instruction argument, several of our cases, along with Rutledge from the Supreme Court, seem to suggest that multiple convictions trigger double jeopardy only when additional convictions result in some form of punishment. Here, the second conviction for manslaughter was vacated. How does it have any punitive effect on your client?
Oh, because the choices there are no longer there. It is huge. I mean, yes, the fact that the part of the judgment regarding manslaughter one was taken out, that is true. However, the alternative counts instruction fundamentally alters the choice that a jury has when it is given and when it is not given. And this is a case where you had four choices, all in line on related topics. And we know from U.S. versus Ball, and we know, or Ball versus U.S., excuse me, and U.S. versus Rutledge, that it's not just whether a sentence is there. It's a conviction and sentence. They come together. You can't just wash one away. Those are U.S. Supreme Court cases. And for whatever reason, they weren't cited in Wilcox.
Explain the idea of how it alters their choice, though.
Excuse
explain
me?
The idea of how it alters their choice.
Because they are forced, they are instructed to choose one and acquit on the others, not a bunch.
And why should they be instructed that they're required to do that when the facts could, Justice Kern just pointed out, that it would not be a double jeopardy problem if the lesser offenses that they convict of are not sentenced on. So it's not double jeopardy. What is it that requires the court to give the instruction and make them make that choice?
State versus Wells, but I disagree with the assumption that it's not double jeopardy. I think you, for whatever reason, U.S. versus Ball versus U.S. and U.S. versus Rutledge was overlooked. And there are things in terms of punishments that can come along with conviction.
Tell me your Wells argument then.
Oh, the Wells argument is you had the person was convicted of two, a husband and a wife were convicted of two theft-like offenses that both, the main focus was on possession of the item. And the problem with that is they requested, as we did, an alternative count instruction, because double jeopardy would not allow, in our case, two convictions and sentences for one death. It's the one conviction, one death rule that's there. And the remedy was, it wasn't just simply just having a concurrent sentence. What's the big deal? It's a concurrent sentence. Who's going to know? There's all sorts of other things that can go along with it. And in that case, it was a little weird. They didn't ask for a new trial in Wells.
So
I don't know why they didn't.
What are those other things that would go along with it that would force the court to give the alternative instruction, or to force the jury to make a decision between these four possible offenses?
Well, that alternative count instruction comes from Wells. That was a decision from this court.
Are you talking about Well?
Well, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, but are you talking about that case?
Yeah.
Okay, that's an assault case, right?
I thought it was more of a theft type.
In any event, is Well even a double jeopardy case?
I believe so, because you're talking about having two convictions for the same act.
Actually, Well says there can't be two convictions for the same factual occurrence or something like that. But isn't the rule really that you can't be punished twice for the same offense?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of might matter.
Well, I think with homicide cases, especially like this, with the offenses that are...
Perhaps with homicide
it's
cases.
It's so much cleaner than whether or not you walk 17 yards with the stolen item.
You could be right about that.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just one death. It's very clean. And by statute, the murder homicide offenses are lesser included of the other. And if you have evidence, you can get lesser included. The statute says they are lesser included, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And
no, it does.
You've got to prove that there's evidence to back it up. I can see that.
I'm not raising my eyes about your argument, Mr. Kitty. You say it exactly right. I just wonder sometimes idly if a statute can really do that when you're talking about a constitutional principle under double jeopardy. But that's by the by.
Well, I think the constitutional principles and the statutes can be in line. They can run parallel. There's not an either-or zero-sum game aspect to this.
So I understand the practical value of saying, pick one, make the jury pick one, because, and I know it's a practice in Minnehaha County that they don't make them pick one frequently, and then you'll have four convictions but only sentence on one, and then the other convictions are lying out there in wait in case the original conviction gets reversed or something like that.
What a pretext that is, Your Honor. How many homicide convictions are being overturned in this state?
But my question for you is, I understand the practical reason why you would want to do that. What I'm asking about is, what requires the court to give the instruction?
The precedence of Wells, a standard jury instruction that has been around for a while, and it avoids the problem. It takes care of all of this stuff we're talking about up front.
So, counsel, we do have more recent cases that I think clearly say that, these different types of counts relating to homicide can be separately submitted to the jury for the jury to vote on. So what about those cases? I mean,
I'm not sure which. Are you talking about South Dakota cases?
Yes.
About U.S. Supreme Court cases? Well, I'm saying that if there is any conflict with those cases, and Wall versus U.S. And U.S. versus Rutledge and Milanovic, that I think you have to yield to those.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about your witness, Robinson?
Yes.
You subpoenaed him.
Mm-hmm.
He refused to come. Did you at any point move the circuit court to have him physically brought, or move to have the witness held in contempt, or take any further steps once you were notified that he was refusing to come, leave his cell and be transported to the courthouse, to be exact?
Your Honor, the first order was a transport order.
Yeah.
From the court. That court ordered that.
Okay.
And then we were talking because we were, pressed for time because the case was ending fairly soon. And so we were begging the trial court, can we just send someone back? What's going to happen when there's a drug case and the state wants someone, an informant, who's serving time on the Hill and he doesn't want to come? Chances are they're going to send someone out there to get it. And we asked. We tried to get him subpoenaed. We tried to get the sheriff to go out there, and there's an exhibit showing us. They said, no, thank you, we aren't. And then I asked, okay, give me another day. We have three more days of this week, and we're ending the case just today. We can't wait another day to get them over here.
So can you go back over the facts, please?
Yes.
How it went down factually. So there was an order for transport.
Yes.
He refused to leave his cell.
That's right.
He was then subpoenaed. Your subpoena was served on him?
On
day two. And then he still wouldn't leave the cell. And then you asked for the issuance of a second subpoena for day three. Do you recall the factual details how that went down?
First it was the transporter. Then Tuesday, when we were noticing we had a problem, I first asked for, I think, a continuance at first. And then I said, well, can we try to subpoena them? And the judge said, oh, only if you could try it today. And then he says, I don't think it's going to work, though. And so we tried to do it today. We were trying to do as many cures as we could for the problem under pressure. And I don't know that it's a waiver on my part, if I make the request and it's denied, that I have to suggest every conceivable cure to a trial court. They have some obligation to do these things. And the things get a little hot under the collar. It's my nature, unfortunately. But this is not going to happen when it's the state witness in the pen. They're going to get them.
So is the answer to the question that you did not ask to have him transported and compelled as a compulsory matter brought down from hell?
I think I did, because I think I'm talking about delaying the case to another day, and then we had 3 days, so we're not in a rush to get it done.
See,
there's an extensive conversation in there about it.
Okay.
Did I make a distinction between a subpoena order and an order from the court? I probably was talking about subpoenas at that point, because on any given day, the DOC will transport a person from the penitentiary, or the sheriff will go there and pick them up. It's really on who. It's depending on who's got staff who can do it. And but the point is, law enforcement that has someone imprisoned surely can exercise force, reasonable means or what have you, to compel the attendance of a witness. And we all know that if a state wants a witness who's in the pen, that person is coming.
So, of course, getting them there is one thing. Then you got to get them to testify. So if you have a reluctant witness, whether you get them there or not, may or may not happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like you also have an argument with regard to unavailability and how it would, what you wanted to put in should have come in.
Well,
do I understand that right, or explain that?
Well, we had two unavailable witnesses. We had Mr. Poore, who exercises right, the co-defendant who since pled out, and we had Mr. Robinson. So we had two. And the problem we got into is it got down because Robinson had a criminal record. Go figure, in the penitentiary, he would have felonies on his record. That made him unreliable. That was one of the main reasons that was there. There were some other reasons, too, that were cited. But that made him unreliable. But if you brought him there, pursuant to subpoena statutes, and the Constitution of the state of South Dakota and the United States, you would actually have them there. And you can make a credibility determination despite the criminal record. And there's a jury instruction I cite in my reply brief that talks about how you need to make the credibility determination based on the testimony. And there was no testimony from the guy. You can't see, you know, is he breaking out in a sweat when he's making an answer. You can't make that credibility determination, which could be made if you just brought him down. And they didn't do that. When there's 3 days left. I mean, it's just what concerns me is you know where the witness is. You can bring him because he's in custody. Yeah, they might not be happy. Who is happy to be transported around to a hearing where they might testify? And I give you the example of if this happens in a drug deal case, they're going to bring him. And he might really not want to go because he would be at risk to himself. We're not just being charged with new things, but, you know, having criminal elements terrorize the witness. But you can still bring him safely. You can still make him secure. And they would. I don't know of any case, anecdotally, or where it was an issue that the state couldn't bring a witness from the penitentiary when they needed it. I didn't ever see
that. Yeah, but we're focused on error in this case, mm-hmm. not, you know, whether you think the state would have a better deal or better treatment. So, I mean, that's the problem here. Not whether you're treated unfairly or your perception is that the state wouldn't have had the same trouble. What's the error here?
With regards to the transport issue?
Yes.
We have a right to compel the attendance of witnesses. We use available means to do that per state statute and authorized under the umbrella of the state constitution and the federal constitution. Those are the means to the end. And we ask for it. It's not like it's like 5 minutes before the hearing and we realize, hey, we need a continuance because we need to get this person here and there was no notice to everybody. Everyone knew about this. Everyone knew about this.
So you sought an order for transport. It was
yes.
granted. It was served. He refused to come out of his mm-hmm. cell. He was then subpoenaed.
Yes.
He still refused
well, actually,
to come out of his
he
cell.
He wasn't subpoenaed the okay. second time because we were told, go try to subpoena them even though I know it won't work. And we tried it, even though we probably thought it wasn't going to work, but we're going to try. And then there's a letter, there's an email attached to that was admitted into evidence. It's in the appendix of my brief that shows the sheriff's department says that they weren't going to do it.
But he was subpoenaed, correct? Yes or no?
I don't know if the subpoena got out because they weren't going over there at all. I don't know that if the second that subpoena was actually served or they just said they couldn't do it. But that's the process. You go tell them, and then they go serve them.
But you didn't move for further relief. You didn't ask the court, look, I want him physically transported. I want you to go out and physically take him into custody and bring him here. Or under penalty of contempt, I'm going to move to have him held in contempt. I'm just trying to, and I'll go back and read these sections of the record.
Did I ask for someone that I wanted the subpoena to be held in contempt? No, I didn't. I didn't think I had to because of the statutes that grant us the power to get people, and we had a court order saying he had to be there.
It happens that sometimes people don't show up when they're subpoenaed, even when they're not in custody.
Yeah, and then you can ask for things like I was talking about, a continuance to allow us to do that. No, only that day. So, yeah, I am asking for more things, but I was shot down immediately. No, we're not going to have the jury wait till Wednesday, when it's a Tuesday, and they all said that they could stay till Friday. Do I have to keep asking? This is just a rhetorical question. Do I have to keep asking every day, pretty please, have you reconsidered? Move to reconsider every morning? When it was clear that he was giving, the only means he let me have was to try to get him there that day when he knew. He says it in the record. He knew it would not happen.
Mr. Cady, your time's up. You'll have a rebuttal. I don't know if
sure.
there's any other questions.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Dempsey, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Stephen Tuope beat Chris Musso to death in an act of revenge. Tuope chased Musso for 300 feet while facing no imminent threat. Musso fell while his back was turned, and Tuilpe rained punches and kicks on the grounded man. This gave Jeff Poor time to catch up and join in on the beating. And when they were finished, they left Musso bloodied in the street. The video of the beating showed that Tuilpe picked something up after he was done and put it in his pocket. And he was photographed that night with spiked brass knuckles. The spike on the knuckles matched Musso's autopsy photo of a circular fracture in his forehead. And Dr. Snell testified a traumatic brain injury inflicted by a blunt force object was the cause of death.
Did it match it, or was it consistent with it?
Consistent. Either way, the jury could look at that fracture and determine that the spiked knuckles from that photograph were consistent with it. That rationally supports the verdict in light of the testimony and in light of all the other evidence, including the blood on his jeans and the video of him beating this man on the ground.
So counsel has advocated that this is the reason why they wanted to have Robinson brought over to give this contrary, information that Poor had brass knuckles. So can you respond to your thoughts about what went down there and whether there was any error?
So there was no error. Tuilpe wanted the circuit court to allow double hearsay into the trial. He wanted Marino to testify that Robinson said that Poor said something, and he wanted Marino to make that testimony because Robinson was refusing to testify. This is exactly the situation envisioned by Rule 804. There's a declarant under order. They will not testify. So regardless of if he refused to leave his cell or if he showed up and refused to do it in person, 804 would still apply. And then the court had to determine if there were corroborating circumstances that clearly indicated trustworthiness to allow the statement. And it had to do with both statements.
We don't know if he would have showed up and refused to do it because he didn't show up.
I suppose that's true. However, he was still a declarant unavailable. So it's a matter of, do we forcibly transport him? And what it seemed to be to me is that he didn't want to be a snitch, basically. He didn't want to leave his cell. There was this issue that perhaps he said something about Poor, and he...
So you started that by saying, do we compel him to leave his cell? Mr. Cady makes this very emotional argument about, hey, if it was the state needed him as a witness, the state would have compelled him to leave the deal. And then you suggest like it was a choice, like like the state or the court made a choice. Well, we're not going to compel him to leave the cell. Is that what happened?
There are practical issues with, for one, forcing a defendant or a witness to leave their cell. It could be dangerous for law enforcement. There's a lot of hypothetical.
Well, let's focus on the error. And as I kind of tried to talk to Mr. Cady, we had this discussion as well. Is there error, not necessarily in the evidentiary ruling, but at a more fundamental level, is there a point at which the judge makes a decision that is challenged here that impacted whether this witness should have been there or not? Should the judge have done something? Was he asked to do something to ensure his attendance? What does the record reveal in that regard?
The facts are that a subpoena and transport order had been issued, and that they found out...
Was issued?
Yes. And they found out that Robinson was refusing to leave his cell. And so, substantively, this is the same as a refusal to testify. It's a declarant under subpoena to come to the trial and testify refusing to do so. That places it under 804. There's nothing in the law suggesting that there's an affirmative duty requiring a physical transport. It becomes an issue of a declarant being unavailable, and the court's examination of that point of law was exactly correct.
So, but if there's a subpoena and the person doesn't comply, and then the party who requested the subpoena says, enforce the subpoena, the court has an obligation to do something about, either make a decision whether to enforce the subpoena or not. Question is, did that occur? Did the party who requested the subpoena say, enforce the subpoena?
That did occur. And what the court's solution was, because there wasn't going to be testimony, was to allow Tuilpe to make an offer of proof, make his objections on the record. The court's solution was to determined that the declarant was unavailable because he was. And there's nothing in the law that I know of that requires a court to forcibly transport a potential witness when they're refusing to leave their cell. Once they disobey that order, it becomes a declarant unavailable issue.
Counsel, I want to turn your attention to the introduction of the page from the defendant's notebook that had the reference of the word sino on it, along with what I'll describe as unfavorable lyrics or narrative text contained therein. Now, there's an argument that it was error to admit that, and the argument is, well, it's admitted for identity, and that it was error to admit the entire page because of the unfavorable text that could potentially paint the defendant in a negative light. Was it error, and if so, was it prejudicial error?
There was no prejudice due to the court's limiting instruction. Jurors are presumed to understand and follow limiting instructions. Here the jury was instructed to ignore those jottings, and there's no reason to believe that they did not follow that instruction. So there was no prejudice. And even if there were prejudice, it should have been excluded under 403, which it was highly relevant to attaching him to the name Sino anyway. In a 403 balancing test, it is to substantially outweigh. It did not. But even if it should have been excluded, take it out. What are you left with? You've got a video of Tuopei chasing him down. You've got a video of him attacking him on the ground. He leaves him bloodied in the street. In the Frias case, the defendant left the victim for dead, bleeding out, and that sustained a murder conviction. So them leaving him to bleeding in the street, he could have been hit by a car, he could have bled out. He winds up getting emergency medical services and dying in the hospital. There's proof of a depraved mind there that rationally supports the verdict. Furthermore, Tuopei's on video picking something up after the assault. He's photographed with a spike on his knuckles. It's consistent with the fracture on the forehead, and they have Dr. Snell's testimony. So given that overwhelming evidence, any prejudice from this exhibit is totally eclipsed. And there wasn't any to begin with because of the limiting instruction.
Hey, Counsel, I'd also like you to address the contention that there was impermissible vouching that occurred by the prosecutor during the closing argument when the prosecutor made the statement, "My job is justice."
So there was no vouching. This court looks at vouching as a matter of bolstering witness testimony. There was no bolstering of witness testimony going on there. The circumstances of that statement where the defense said in the closing, but they tried to sell you that anyway, regarding that Tuopei had clean shoes in his apartment. The implication was that the prosecutor was trying to put one over on the jury. So in her closing, she makes the statement about herself, "I'm not trying to sell anything. My job is justice and bringing people to justice." So there was no vouching because it was never about a witness statement.
Prosecutor, I understand that the prosecutor may have felt some compulsion to respond and maybe something was appropriate. Do you think it's possible, however, the jury could have reasonably interpreted that passage to essentially say to the jury, "I'm the righteous one. Believe my evidence."
If a prosecutor brings a case to trial, they're already saying to the jury that they think they've got evidence to find someone guilty.
How about, "I'm the righteous one. Believe my evidence because I'm the righteous one."
The statement was, "My job is justice, bringing people to justice." Maybe it was a little dramatic, but it was also in response to, they're trying to put one over on you. There's ill motives here. And the statement was exclusively about herself. So vouching, and this is from Nelson, this is from Manning, this is from Snodgrass, it has to be about a witness testimony. There's no statement that it bolstered. In fact, in the first brief, appellant does mention Detective Marino, but only for the context that Marino said Tuopei had clean shoes. He never affirmatively argued that she bolstered Marino. The issue was the statement, "My job is justice."
You don't think that's lending the prestige of a prosecutor's office to sort of invoke the office to say, "I'm here to do the right thing and I'm believable. I'm not only not a salesman, but I have the right cause here. You should believe my evidence"?
I do not believe so because it wasn't specifically about a witness's testimony. And the statement...
Is that proper then? Is that argument, whether it comments on a witness's testimony or not, is that a proper argument?
Closing arguments are not evidence. In the context of the implication that there's some ill motive here or that she's trying to put one over on the jury, yes, it is proper because she has to restore her credibility as an advocate. If the court has no more questions on this issue, there's several to get around to. Regarding jury instructions, there's an appeal of the speculation and conjecture instruction. That exact same instruction was said to uphold the, or correctly state the law in Krieger. So Tuopay got what he was entitled to. A defendant is not entitled to whatever he wants. He's entitled to an accurate statement of the law. Regarding the alternative counts instruction, in every single one of these cases argued in the briefs, the holdings are, to avoid double jeopardy violations, courts must vacate the lesser charge and sentence on the greater charge. It's about sentencing. It goes to punishment. In the Ball case, the court acknowledged that a jury can return two guilty verdicts. So it's not a matter of there can't be two guilty verdicts. They have to pick one verdict and pick a charge. All that would function to do is confuse jurors over sentencing decisions. And in Ball, the holding was, if you do have two guilty verdicts, you vacate the lesser offense and sentence on the greater offense. In Rutledge, the U.S. Supreme Court went as far as to say that if the greater offense is overturned on appeal, the lesser offense can be reinstated. And that's consistent. This court followed this reasoning in Well and Wilcox. The solution, if there's concurrent sentences on one death, it's always remanded for resentencing, not a second trial with an alternative counts instruction. I want to talk about Dr. Snell's testimony a little bit. There was some argument that he speculated. He did not speculate. He provided an exact cause of death, a traumatic brain injury caused by a blunt force object. He did not decipher that one specific blow caused that brain injury. All of the blows contributed to that brain injury. But there's a traumatic brain injury, and that's the cause of death. Had to be caused by a blunt force object. His hypotheticals were not speculation. They were examples within Dr. Snell's area of expertise with an evidentiary basis. In Nelson, this court said it was not abuse to allow hypotheticals about blood alcohol content in different situations because it was within the expert's area of expertise and had an evidentiary basis. Here, the area of expertise is the cause of death, a traumatic brain injury, and the evidentiary basis is the photographs, the videos, the autopsy report. Compare that to Kavasnica. There, the issue was that testimony was generally about the damage a vehicle could do, and the issue was it was not specific. Here, Dr. Snell's illustrations were specific. They were specifically about Musso's head injury and the type of force that was necessary to cause the kind of damage and why it had to be with an object. So the mention of a ballpoint hammer or a fall, that is all about the amount of force it would take and the fact that it had to be with an object, about that specific cause of death. Regarding the immunity hearing, so what the state is seeing with this appeal is a defendant trying to get review on appeal away from the well-established sufficiency of the evidence standard and make things about the immunity hearing. But this court already shut the door on that in State versus Smith. It said that there was no prejudice from not having an immunity hearing because a jury verdict beyond a reasonable doubt meant there was no prejudice in not having the immunity hearing. So the jury verdict means that a ruling of a clear and convincing rebuttal was proper. Here we have the immunity hearing. We have the ruling that a clear and convincing rebuttal was made. The court issued very thorough and accurate findings of fact and conclusions of law. And it was correct in making that determination because a jury found Tuopay guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And just look at the evidence in the findings of fact. Musso engaged in a tactical retreat that's supported by the video. He never moved forward to re-engage after he throws that first right hook. He fell and clearly posed no threat to Tuopay, and the punches and kicks far out exceeded the threat he ever faced. Tuopay used deadly force because he struck multiple forceful blows, and Musso suffered a litany of injuries, which the injuries were not just to his head. He had a broken hand bone. He had broken ribs on both sides. He had extensive bruising. This shows Tuopay had an intent to commit serious bodily injury, and he left him to die in the street. And Musso ultimately did die. So I'm nearing the end of my time here. That does it for my argument, if the court doesn't have any further questions. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Katie, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I've heard a restatement of several arguments in the appellee brief that don't cover the whole issue. For instance, vouching just doesn't necessarily mean that you're covering for a particular state witness. U.S. versus Young, a United States Supreme Court case, talks about it also covers a prosecutor's opinion as to guilt. And with regards to that particular case, yes, I did call attention to this odd part of the case where they said, oh, maybe he cleaned his sneakers, which clearly weren't cleaned at all because you could see what they were like that day. With regards to the speculation instruction in the beginning being good enough, and then there was a case called Krieger that said that that was okay. Well, in this case, we had the prosecutor, right after talking about I am justice, saying, you just go ahead and speculate. So it shows a lack of respect for the instructions that are provided that they're actually in favor of at some point. The spike on the knuckles. Schnell talked about a blunt object. He did not say at any point a specific blunt object. They had plenty of opportunity to shove photos in front of his face to ask, and now they're just bringing up the stuff about this spike on appeal for the first time. It's not in evidence. You need to have expert evidence to tie that in. They didn't do that. With regards to the limiting instruction on Exhibit 37, it says to read it for issues of identification, but still to read it. It didn't say just read the top line. It went all the way down. You go that whole. They were going to read the whole thing to identify the defendant. And what did it talk about? Killing haters, the N-word constantly being used, looking at someone's last breath, and all this kind of stuff. And that goes directly to the issues that we're presenting. It's difficult to effectively advocate for not guilty or perhaps a lesser charge that has a reckless element in it if you're talking about killing haters. That stuff affects their choice. And with regards to the instruction talking about picking one verdict, that shows that they focus in on one. In this case, they didn't. They picked two. We got less deliberation because of the lack of the instruction. That's how we are prejudiced. You also are telling the jury, you've got to come up with one, not guilty or one of the other. And so there's just more to it that is being stated. Opposing counsel talked about with regards to Robinson's lack of attendance. Well, he talks about it seems to me he didn't want to be a snitch. There's no evidence of the reasons why. Just throwing that out there. There is no evidence of it. The reasons weren't stated as evidence in this case. A couple of things that were not stated about the facts. Mousseau didn't run away after the first punch. He was jumping and jockeying his position. That was even recognized by Judge Power, that there was kind of this strategic hopping and whatnot. And even later, before falling down, he takes a swing at my client. So this just wasn't running away in fear. He was hopping around looking for a better position. So it's not as clean or as easy as it's being suggested. And with regards to the first finding that I wanted to call the court's attention to regarding the instruction for simple assault, that was objected to at trial, but it was not challenged by using a notice of review to say that it should have been granted. And if you don't do that, you waive that issue. And State v. O'Connor says that. And I would wish that this court would not try to get at that issue again, because we know it is very frowned on to bring up an issue that is not brought to this court by the parties. I would refer to Signing Smith versus the U.S., and of course, Ali versus Young for that proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess. In fact, this will be the last oral argument of the term.